It's Friday, January 28th. It stinks to train your replacement. Stephen Breyer wouldn't have it any other way. We start here. Justice Stephen Breyer announces he'll retire when his replacement shows up.
And that person will be the first black woman ever nominated to the United States Supreme Court.
We've got our hands on President Biden's shortlist. We'll let you know who's on it. A book has been banned for being too horrific, but it's about the Holocaust.
Many are calling this censorship.
A new argument about cancel culture in schools. And our stoves leak gas more than we think.
It's very easy for it to leak out of the pipes, leak out of the fixtures.
A new study on cookware ignites concerns about our health and our planet. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. It's a pretty absurd idea that in 200 years of American jurisprudence, there's never been a black woman capable of sitting on the Supreme Court. Like, I hope it's not a controversial thing to say. The math there just does not add up.
That's ludicrous. I mean, that's suggesting that a black woman should not be a part of the most important court in our nation, that there aren't black women who have distinguished themselves by rising to the top of the legal profession with the strongest credentials imaginable. There are.
During the 2020 presidential race, when Joe Biden was hurting for progressive cred, he made a promise that if he got the chance to pick a Supreme Court justice, he would right that historic wrong. And yet, it's one thing to say, eventually, this thing should happen. At some point in the circumstance, I hope to be the one to break the mold. No, it's another thing to say, I'm the one doing it, and I'm doing it right now.
I've made no decision except one. The person I will nominate will be someone with extraordinary qualifications, character, experience, and integrity. And that person will be the first black woman ever nominated to the United States Supreme Court.
Well, yesterday at the White House, Justice Stephen Breyer officially announced he would be stepping down from the bench. And in front of the nation, President Biden reaffirmed that promise. And with that, he began one of the most important hiring searches of his career. ABC senior White House correspondent Mary Bruce was there for this announcement yesterday. Mary, what did you hear from the president? What did you hear from Justice Breyer?
Well, first and foremost, we heard from Justice Breyer making it official. Yesterday, he officially hand-delivered his letter of resignation to President Biden, now sparking what will be a very extensive search, as you mentioned. Not quite, a little different from most job hunts, I suspect. But Justice Breyer announcing that he will complete the term and he will remain until his successor is confirmed.
During his confirmation hearings way back in 1994, nominee Stephen Breyer said, quote, "The law must work for the people."
The president is promising he'll nominate someone who will uphold Breyer's legacy. And I have to say, Brad, Breyer isn't someone that I know. I haven't really heard that much from him directly. And yesterday, when he was in the Roosevelt Room with the president, it was really fascinating, I thought, to hear him speak, you know, almost more as a grandfather in many ways than as a Supreme Court justice.
Of course, people don't agree. But we have a country that is based on human rights, democracy, and so forth. But I'll tell you what Lincoln thought, what Washington thought, and what people today still think. It's an experiment.
He had a really interesting parting message for this country, a country that right now is really divided. But he had this parting message about the future of democracy, saying,
"It's that next generation and the one after that, my grandchildren and their children. They'll determine whether the experiment still works. And of course, I am an optimist. And I'm pretty sure it will."
This now kicks off a frantic search by President Biden to not only fill that campaign promise to name the first black woman to the Supreme Court, but this is also, of course, a lifetime appointment. This is something that this president, of course, is the former chair himself of the Senate Judiciary Committee, a process that he takes very, very seriously, Brad.
Well, you mentioned an important detail that we should remember going forward is Breyer says he will not step down from the court until not only his successor is nominated, but until his successor is confirmed. So he says he wants a very clean transition here. Who could replace him? Like, do you have names, Mary?
There are several contenders that we believe are being considered. The front runner right now, we believe, is Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson.
It is the beauty and the majesty of this country that someone who comes from a background like mine could find herself in this position.
She's a graduate of Harvard Law and actually a former law clerk for Breyer. And she's also already gone through the Senate confirmation process. Last year, she earned the support of three Republican senators when she was placed on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals.
Judge Brown Jackson, for example, has experience as a public defender. Justice Alito was a prosecutor, but we don't have anybody on the court right now and haven't in a while with that kind of experience.
Now, also thought to be on this list right now is Judge Leandra Kruger of the California Supreme Court. She's also a graduate of Harvard and Yale. She's actually argued 12 cases before the court.
Wisconsin-born Judge Leslie Abrams Gardner is also a top contender. A former assistant U.S. attorney, graduate of Yale and Brown, and the sister of voting rights advocate Stacey Abrams.
And one more name to put on the list, Brad, Judge J. Michelle Childs of the U.S. District Court of South Carolina.
A Detroit-born former state Labor Department official, employment lawyer, and mother of two. Her law degree from the University of South Carolina, a public school, would add a new educational background to the high court.
She has the backing of Biden's close ally, Senator Jim Clyburn. He's arguing hard for her.
So, I mean, we keep talking about whether Republicans would come on board. Some have already expressed, you know, frustration that President Biden is limiting his search, that he's defining this by race and by gender. But I'm thinking Republicans aren't necessarily the only group he has to worry about, right? Over the last year, we've learned that Democrats don't necessarily vote for whatever he wants. Is there a chance President Biden could be stalled by Democrats as well?
I don't think that's likely to happen here. Look, this is different from some of those policy fights where we have seen one or two Democrats be able to block the president's agenda. In fact, we've already heard from Senator Joe Manchin, who has stood in the way of some of the president's top priorities so far. He says he's open to supporting a nominee, even if they are a little bit to the left of his positions. So a reminder here, of course, of the math. They need just 51 to confirm a Supreme Court nominee. If you add in Vice President Kamala Harris, if he gets his party on board, they'll be able to do this. But that said, you know, the president did say yesterday that he is going to be reaching out to Republicans as well for their input.
I will fully do what I said I'd do. I will fulfill my duty to select a justice, not only with the Senate's consent, but with his advice.
And we have already learned that the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Dick Durbin, has been reaching out to some of his Republican colleagues. He's called Senator Susan Collins. So there is outreach, which, of course, we haven't always seen when it comes to these what have been very partisan confirmations in the past. I'm thinking about the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett that was rushed through, of course, right before the last presidential election.
I felt that the timetable for the last nominee was too compressed. This time, there is no need for any rush.
Yes, Democrats want to move quickly here. This White House, the president says he will have a name. He will announce a pick by the end of next month. So they're looking to move quickly here. They're also hoping to work across the aisle. But they, again, they don't necessarily need to.
Yeah, Dick Durbin really making a point to say, we're going to do this. This is going to look more old school than you might have been used to in the last few years. However, when push comes to shove, we'll see if Democrats just push forward with 50 votes. Mary Bruce at the White House. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up on Start Here, your students can't flunk the test if they're not allowed to learn about the topic. The newest banned books after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
One of the biggest elections of last year might have hinged on one moment. This was in Virginia, where Democrat Terry McAuliffe was running for governor. He's super well-known. His Republican opponent, Glenn Youngkin, has much lower name ID. But at a debate, McAuliffe is blasting the idea of banning books, limiting school curricula. And he says,
I don't think parents should be telling schools what they should teach. But
I don't think parents should be telling schools what they should teach. A little over a month later, he had lost that election. And in the last year, more and more school districts have been tussling with parental concerns. What's appropriate, what's not, what's actually educational.
The McMinn County School Board voted 10-0 recently to ban the Pulitzer Prize winning book, Mouse.
And recently in Tennessee, a firestorm was ignited when a school board voted unanimously to ban a famous book about the Holocaust. It happened earlier this month, but the reason you might have heard about it yesterday is because a lot of people were learning about this on Holocaust Remembrance Day. ABC's Kiara Alfonseca covers race and culture for us. Kiara, what happened here?
Yeah, so a school board in Tennessee pulled a Pulitzer Prize winning book called Mouse from their schools. And it's a graphic novel that tells the story of the author's parents' time in Nazi concentration camps during the Holocaust.
The image of mice seemed appropriate. In Mein Kampf, you find references to Jews specifically as vermin. This is Hitler's metaphors, not mine. Logical animal for a mouse to worry about is a cat.
It also talks, you know, about the mass murder of Jews by Nazis, his mother's suicide. So very difficult, but very real topics.
The board emphasized that their issues were not with the teaching of the Holocaust, but just with the language.
Some of the board members had this really long discussion, heard from parents. They didn't like the vulgarity. They didn't like the cuss words. They didn't like nudity. So they decided to pull it unanimously.
It's a form of suppression of ideas. It's a form of domination.
This sparked outrage, and many are calling this censorship. And this is particularly interesting because the Nazis that these students are supposed to be reading about had a history of banning and burning books and art. So it caused a lot of debate about parents' role in schools.
Trying to be tolerant of people who may possibly not be Nazis.
The author of Mouse, Art Spiegelman, is completely baffled by this. He called the school board's decision Orwellian, and he's just really afraid for the students who've told him that they've learned so much from his book about the Holocaust and about the different ways that marginalized communities have been oppressed in the past.
But it does bring up, like, I was looking at the minutes of this school board meeting, and you could see teachers trying to say, hey, you know, like, we get a lot out of this in our curriculum. Yes, it gets uncomfortable. Yes, curse words can get weird. And the question from almost all the school board members was, well, if parents don't like what the kids are learning, like, shouldn't the parents have a say there? And that doesn't seem like something that's just limited to one county in Tennessee at this point.
So this conversation is happening across the country with books, with lesson plans, with just classroom discussions. And in Florida, actually, earlier this month, we saw state officials consider what LGBTQ advocates are calling Don't Say Gay bills, which would restrict classroom discussions around LGBTQ issues, history, literature, and more.
The book, titled Gender Queer, a Memoir, is a graphic novel depicting the author's journey of gender identity and sexual orientation. Parents are now concerned it may be inappropriate for their children.
I've actually read what's in those books, and I'm proud that they've been removed from our shelves and we've made the right decision for kids.
Legislators say that they don't want to encourage classroom discussions about sexual orientation or gender identity for children who are too young, you know, banning content that isn't age appropriate, which is a very vague term that a lot of educators are really concerned about.
No government, and public school is an extension of government, has ever banned books and banned information from its public and been remembered in history as the good guys.
The biggest thing that we're hearing from activists and educators alike is that this not only erases LGBTQ presence from schools, you know, implying to students that their gender identity or their sexual orientation is something to be ashamed of or hidden, but they're also just worried about the children losing sight of the contributions and important lessons from the LGBTQ community, from the LGBTQ rights movement.
Conversations about us aren't something dangerous that should be banned. That's deeply prejudicial, and it sends a terrible message to our young people, including LGBTQ young people or young people who have LGBTQ parents.
And this fear from educators and activists also extends to some of the other legislation that we've seen across the country with anti-critical race theory bills and other anti-LGBTQ bills.
Teaching kids to hate their country and to hate each other is not worth one red cent.
That's not the purpose of critical race theory. It's really the opposite, you know, to help us to be more inclusive.
It's kind of like that saying, those who ignore history are doomed to repeat it. So the LGBTQ rights movement, Jim Crow, race riots, lynching, the Holocaust, if these children aren't taught about these very vital moments in history and shown the moral wrong of our country, educators are really concerned that these children will not be prepared to tackle the world that they're walking into.
Yeah, it's been interesting because some of the parents are saying, I don't have a problem with the lesson plan. Like, I want my kids to learn about the Holocaust. And the Holocaust was terrible. I don't need the curse words. I don't need the other stuff crowding that. A lot of educators and a lot of people, for example, in the Jewish community have said, never forget means that you're going to have terrible images seared into your brain. That is actually part of the learning process. And by the way, teachers say the lesson plan is about learning to express these thoughts, learning to express these horrors. Chiara Alfonseca on a really multifaceted story here. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
I feel like we've all gotten very in touch with our kitchens over the last couple years. Like, even if you weren't a chef before the pandemic, you probably got used to staying home and cooking something. But yesterday, a new study came out claiming that if you use a gas stove, you know, you turn the knob, click, 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 blue flame, the classic stove, that could be emitting harmful gases, even if you're not using it. Harmful for the environment and harmful to you. Let's bring in ABC Stephanie Ebbs, who covers the environment. Stephanie, wait, I got a gas stove in my kitchen. I just had to go make sure it was turned off. What are the risks here that we're talking about?
Yeah, thanks, Brad. So I think we're all familiar with these stoves. They're desirable for a lot of reasons. Like, people like the aesthetic. They like the way they cook. But some researchers at Stanford University recently took a look at kind of the climate and health consequences of these stoves. And I want to put them in context. About a third of households in the U.S. cook with gas stoves. That's 40 million homes.
Get the gas advantage, a natural for your home.
We love gas.
So the researchers at Stanford took a look at 53 homes using gas stoves in California. They measured gases that were emitted while the stoves were in use, while they were turned off, and found that the amount of methane in particular being released by these stoves, altogether, it could warm the planet about the same amount as 500,000 gas-powered cars on the road for a year.
The amount of methane leaking out of stoves was higher than we expected and higher than estimated by the Environmental Protection Agency.
So for those watching climate change, really concerned about our carbon emissions, that's a pretty eye-opening number.
Wait, we're talking about methane being released while the stove is off? Like, I thought, like, when you don't have your stove working, like, the gas just sits in the pipe.
Right. And so that number is altogether methane that would be emitted by using and leaving these stoves dormant. But part of the issue with methane, right, it's a byproduct of natural gas, but it's what happens when the natural gas is not burned. So if you ever hear this debate about abandoned natural gas wells or abandoned fracking wells, the concern is that they are releasing methane just by sitting there.
Most of the natural gas we found leaking into the air wasn't while the stove was in operation, but just simply leaking while it was off from fittings and leaky pipes and things like that.
And so that's the concern with these stoves as well, is that there is a leak somewhere in the system that is causing this gas to be released even when it is turned off.
And then as far as, like, so I get methane really bad for the environment. We talked before about how lots of things that emit methane, like, really contribute to global warming. What happens if I inhale it? Like, is it, like, for personal health, is this a big concern as well?
I mean, you don't want to be inhaling very large amounts of any of these gases, right? And especially indoors, indoor air pollution is obviously a big concern as well. Methane is not the only thing that this study measured. They also looked at nitrogen oxides, or NOx, which is a gas that can be really harmful to people with respiratory sensitivity. If you have asthma, it can exacerbate those issues. And of course, carbon monoxide is also a concern when you're using natural gas inside.
But we can't eliminate the carbon dioxide emissions from burning natural gas. So at some point, and at some point quickly, we need to replace all of our natural gas appliances for cleaner electric appliances.
The biggest thing to note with that is that they said all of these concerns can be mitigated if you're using proper ventilation with a gas stove. So that's if you have a proper hood, using that whenever you cook, using a fan, having that window open, and having the appliances inspected regularly.
Well, and so you mentioned the scope of this study, right? The 40 million gas stoves, they looked at 53 households in California. But there has been a growing debate over, like, this is not the only study that said, like, I don't know about gas stoves. So what do we do? Like, are we all supposed to go out and ditch our stoves tomorrow? What's the plan?
Obviously, that's not realistic to happen, right? This is the large appliance. It's a big expense for a lot of people. I think the thing to know about why this debate is generating so much attention is that there's been a much larger conversation going on about natural gas in recent years. It is seen as a better alternative to coal, but it is still a fossil fuel.
New York City's gas ban for new buildings keeps residents healthy. It will fight the climate crisis, cut deadly air pollution, and deadly gas explosions.
Some states and cities are banning the use of natural gas in new homes and new buildings. Other states are going dramatically in the other direction and saying you are not allowed to ban natural gas.
Texas is going to protect the oil and gas industry from any type of hostile attack.
So this is kind of the, it's the energy debate, the societal debate that we're having around climate change, where there is a need to drastically reduce emissions as much as possible. There's also a very powerful industry and a very powerful political and cultural sense that people don't want to be told what to do. So kind of the takeaway from all of this is that your gas stove has now been drafted into the larger context of political debate around climate change.
Yeah, because everything has to be red or blue, including the blue flames coming out of my stove. All right. Stephanie Abbs, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Okay, we're going to take one more quick break. When we come back, this scandal made Left Shark look like a virtuoso. If you only watch football for the halftime show, listen up. One Last Thing is next.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing. It's a big football weekend. Sunday is the day that will determine which teams play in the Super Bowl. But the lineup for the Super Bowl halftime show is already set, mostly. For weeks, we've known the headline performers will be Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg, Kendrick Lamar, Eminem, and Mary J. Blige. However, there will also be lots of musicians and hundreds of extras. Recently, the LA Times revealed that because those extras would be asked to do some dancing, organizers hired some dancers, but then also put around word to others saying, hey, maybe you'd like to be one of our volunteer performers. That led to professional dancers practicing for 9 days for $0 in preparation for one of the most lucrative events in the world. Of course, that's not nearly the most controversial dance move in this show's history. You might remember back in 2004, Janet Jackson is on stage dancing with Justin Timberlake, who suddenly reaches over and rips off the fabric covering her right breast. It was called a wardrobe malfunction, but it looked pretty choreographed by both of them. Well, now, in a new documentary airing tonight on Lifetime and A&E, Janet Jackson is expected to comment more directly than ever on that moment.
They build you up, and then once you get there, they're so quick to tear you down.
This was shot over 3 years, and at one point in 2018, you see someone in the teaser telling Janet,
Justin and his team have been trying to contact us about you doing the Super Bowl.
Leading to speculation that he might have actually been asking her several years ago to make an appearance in his act, which would have been quite the olive branch. Remember, that moment on live TV lasted 9/16ths of a second, but got Janet Jackson blacklisted for years.
She's only formally discussed it once before with Oprah in 2006, and at that time, pledged never to go into it again.
What was so galling to her fans was it was still barely a speed bump in Timberlake's career. He's since apologized specifically to Jackson and Britney Spears for failing to speak up on their behalves. The question now is, does Janet Jackson forgive him, or does she still think of him as a nasty boy? I mentioned this year's halftime show, the producer Roc Nation says they've had more than 100 union dancers under contract this whole time, and the performers union SAG-AFTRA says you will no longer see any professional dancers working for free on this project. Start Here is produced by Kelly Therese, Brenda Salinas-Baker, Lewis Millman, Madeline Wood, David Toledo, Jen Newman, Vika Aronson, and Tara Gimbel. Ariel Chester is our social media producer. Josh Cohan is our podcast manager. I'm our managing editor. Liz Alessi is our executive producer. Thanks to Lakia Brown, John Newman, Elizabeth Russo, and Stacia Deshishku. Special thanks this week to Chris Berry, Chris Howell, and our man Josh Cohan, who just got married, is on his honeymoon right now. We'll see you when you get back, buddy. I'm Brad Milkey. See you next week.